Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting our show today by talking with you about wild rice. It's a unique crop. It's considered sacred to indigenous people in Wisconsin and neighboring states. There are several threats to wild rice. We'll talk about the crop in general, but also talk about those threats with two guests we have for you. One is Kathleen Smith from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Bonjour.
Jason Fleener, a wildlife habitat specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our other guest today. And Jason, welcome to you.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And great to have you with us. You can join the conversation as well as you listen along. Maybe you have questions about wild rice, its history, or some of its threats. Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Kathleen, let's start with you. Where does wild rice grow in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest?
So it has such a wonderful habitat, a beautiful ecosystem. So we call it an indicator species for good, clean water. So it really loves the mucky substrate. It also loves good, clear water. It grows in about 3 foot of water. So you have an inlet and an outlet in a river system or a lake. So it just loves that good, clean water. So it's persistent in, you know, these areas where you have the ecosystem and all of our orders of creation that has these elements that come together in this beautiful space. So it ideally grows in about 3 feet of water along shorelines or riverine systems. So that's where, you know, our beautiful plant relative really likes to live.
And it's an annual plant, is it not?
Yes, it's an annual plant. So it has a beautiful life cycle. So once it matures, the seed, you know, goes into the substrate. It has this big, long on. It kind of feels like Velcro if you go one way. So when it drops and matures, it drops right into the sediment. So that's where it needs to know winter as well. So once it sits there and gets to know winter, that's where it's really important, you know, for the colder temperatures. We need to have snow and ice to be able to overwinter this beautiful relative of ours.
Yeah.
So once it starts germinating in the springtime, it germinates around 38 degrees or a little bit warmer. So then it becomes submergent. So that's where it kind of lives a little bit longer. And then once the sun kind of comes through, that's why you need good, clean water. And then it starts, you know, photosynthesizing once it gets to floating leaf stage, which is about June. And then in July, it's kind of starts standing up. So then that's where it starts making its own food, and then it starts maturing. So then later on, then you kind of get to the elder stage, I call it, you know, where it starts maturing, where about this time, you know, that seed is just ripening, getting ready to shatter so we can have it for harvest.
And it's a very nutritious food, is it not?
Yes, so Good nutritional value. So it has a higher quality of protein. It's gluten-free. It's a lot better than white rice and brown rice as well.
Yeah. Jason Fleener, turn to you for a minute. The DNR says this year's wild rice crop is low and maybe continuing a trend of recent years. What's causing the low production of wild rice?
Yeah, that's right. And really those the trend is statewide, unfortunately, and what we've been seeing over the course, what I would say the better part of 10 or 20 years is a decline. And some years we'll have some good years and off years. But if you look at the long term trend, it's not promising. The challenges of rice on every individual body of water are different. Some of them are more human influenced challenges with landscape use changes, influences on water flow, damming, culverts, things of that nature, recreational activities, boating and whatnot. But the overall, I guess, threat that's consistent across the board is climate change. And you know, that's due to a number of factors. And like, as Kathy mentioned, the rice, the species that we find here in Wisconsin really depend on those cold winters and ice cover to trigger germination in the spring. So as we encounter more and more of these warmer winters, it doesn't germinate as well. And what we're seeing is in these lakes, some of the competing aquatic plants, like water lily and water shield, for example, tend to have an edge and will outcompete rice under those conditions. And then you couple that with increased rainfall events. We're seeing more events, you know, the 3 to 5 inch plus rains during the vulnerable growing season in May through July. And that can cause a lot of turbidity, sedimentation, and uprooting of the growing rice plants. And then they are no longer successful in growing for that season.
Yeah. Well, Kathleen, your organization, again, I'll remind, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, or GLIFWIC, I think it's called as well, said there was a draw about an 18% less of northern Wisconsin covered by wild rice than last year, which is quite a lot, quite a drop. How do you determine that?
So we determined it by, we have a remote sensing tool. We were able to do it from a scientific point of view as compared to previous year's wild rice. So that's how we were able to compare that, you know, there was a decline in Manoman.
And how large is the geographic area you and GLIFWIC oversee?
We actually oversee our ceded territories, so it's the 1836, 1837, 1842, and 1854 treaty area. So that's what we consider the ceded territory area. So it covers like the western UP, northern Wisconsin, and part of the eastern Minnesota.
That's a large area. Do you have authority, does GLIFWIC have authority to enforce environmental regulations that would protect wild rice beds?
So just our game wardens, they have the authority to do off-reservation. So that's what GLIFWIC does, is we do off-reservation regulations where tribes have their own resources to do their on-reservation. They kind of do their own regulations. So that's what GLIFWIC does, is we kind of, you know, regulate that for off reservation only.
Yeah. Jeff in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, couldn't stay with us, but wants to know why cultivated wild rice is so much different than wild rice that grows, truly grows wild.
So cultivated wild rice, it's genetically modified to ripen all at once, where wild rice is able to ripen at different rates. So that's how, you know, Mother Nature, or, you know, the Gitche Manitou, the creator, has, you know, made wild rice, because we also have to return some back, you know, for our other relatives, return some back for, you know, next year's crop.
And Jason, wild rice is considered a keystone plant species. I don't know, Kathleen might have even mentioned that. What does that mean, actually?
Yeah, it's really vital, critical to the ecosystem functions in a lot of these places where rice is found. There are so many different animals that depend on wild rice or Manoman, you know, so it's not only important for human harvesting and food, but a lot of animals really deeply depend on it. Waterfowl, in particular, ducks love wild rice, and other types of birds, sora rails, blackbirds, muskrats really depend on those ecosystems. And when they're not functioning properly, it kind of throws the ecosystem out of balance.
Yeah, for sure. Kathleen, your title at Glyphwic is She Who Takes Care of the Rice in the Anishinaabe language. I'm wondering, what was your background, and was this position created specifically because of your connection with communities that have long harvested Manuman?
So my position title, that's a very good question. It's Gunawing Dung Manuman, She Who Takes Care of the Wild Rice. So this position was created after Peter and Lisa David had retired from Glyphwic, and tribes actually wanted to have their own cultural perspective. So that's how my position was created. So I bring in the cultural perspective into co-management or co-stewardship, you know, decisions. So we have a great way of bringing in teachings and our traditions, you know, into management decisions. So that's how my position was created.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that it was specifically created. And your background, you have some prior experience to assuming this position.
Yes, I have. I actually worked for my own community, which is located in the Western UP. I'm located in the Launce Indian Reservation, also known as Kuna Bay Indian Community. I was a habitat specialist for my own tribe. I did a lot of native plant restoration, also invasive species program I was a part of, the food sovereignty, which included the community garden. So we also, you know, collected seed and, you know, planted our own medicines as well, you know, because we had brownfield sites in our community because of legacy mining. So we had a lot of stamp sand. The tribe had actually procured this property from the state, which was it's called Sand Point Restoration Site. So we had actually remediated the area and put our own native plant species onto this cap. So that was a little bit of my background, and it also included wild rice restoration. I worked for my tribe for about 6 years. So we actually got seed, and we were able to have, you know, this beautiful medicine, Manuman, in our own community as well.
What does a restoration project look like?
As far as for wild rice? So what we do is we assess the area to see if it has, you know, the inlet and outlet, like I had spoken about. You have to have that gentle flow of water. You also have to have a mucky substrate, and also the ideal conditions is around 3 feet of water. I've seen Manuman grow in, you know, very minimal, like 1 inch of water, all the way up to about 6 feet of water, depending on, you know, the issues that the beautiful connections that it needs to grow. So that's what we first look for, is to see if there's prime habitat. And, you know, we kind of look at the ecological area to see if it will, you know, hold our beautiful relative. Usually Manuman will grow, you know, the first year that you put seed in. If the nutrients is still there, it will still, you know, return back year after year. Sometimes these wild rice beds need to rest, and so it can build up that nutrient cycle back again. So that's when you have a lot of, they call it crop failure. I don't really like to call it a failure, but, you know, as long as it can rest and the nutrients can build back, the Manuman stocks actually take about 2 years to return back to the earth and become a nutrient.
Oh, my goodness. And where do you get the seed?
So we get the seed. A lot of tribes are, they love to harvest their own seed from their own area. But we actually get seed sometimes from Minnesota. But a lot of tribes are trying to bring in, you know, seed from the local area as well. Minnesota actually has the lakes to be able to, you know, procure the seed and to be able to, you know, help other communities along that want Manuman in their area. But they have the lakes where you can go out and you can harvest anywhere from 400 pounds up, depending on, you know, your skills. Here in Wisconsin, it's a lot less because we have a lot less, you know, bigger beds as compared to Minnesota. So for my tribe, we actually go to Minnesota to get the seed, you know, and bring back, because it is the same species as any illustrious.
It's interesting. And do you procure the seed the way it was always done in canoes or other boats, or what do you do?
So how we get the seed is we always harvest in a traditional manner. I do a lot of rice camps as well. So we teach a lot of participants, the proper way of harvesting in a sustainable way. So I always call it light hand on the land. So we use a canoe, which can't be any bigger than 17 foot long versus, 38 inches wide. And then you have two participants in the canoe. One will have a push pole and the other one will have rice knockers. So what you do is you gently bend the stems over your canoe and then you tap the stems so you don't break it because it continues to ripen, like I had said earlier. You want to have enough seed on, there'll be enough seed on there so somebody else can come back and harvest again. But that's how the seed is procured, in that traditional manner, especially for our restoration projects. We take pride in, in our harvest as a people. So when we do have somebody that, gives the or offers their seed up, for restoration, they always make sure and they check and, is the seed growing, because we all just take pride in that.
Really interesting interesting talking with our two guests today. Kathleen Smith is the Manuman Gatawandang Ojibwe for Who Takes Care of the Rice with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. And Jason Fleener, a wetland habitat specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have them with us. And I hope you'll join in. If you have a question or comment about wild rice or growing it or what's going on with it, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about wild rice on the program. Up next, we'll talk with Nick Roy about how state carbon fees on greenhouse gas emissions could lower utility bills for homes and business owners in Wisconsin. And at 12:30, Jeb Barzin and Christina Weld from the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council talk about a new Burn Boss certification program. But right now, we're talking wild rice, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. And Kathleen, before we take any calls, it's Manuman or wild rice is, it's not just food to the Anishinaabe peoples. It's a spirit.
No, it isn't.
Go ahead.
No, it isn't. It's one of our plant relatives, and it sits in that second order order of creation. So it's a beautiful plant relative of ours.
Yeah. And Jason, I want to get back to you for a minute. Who can harvest wild rice in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So harvesting for wild rice is really open to all residents of Wisconsin. Unfortunately, we don't allow out-of-state harvesters. There are some exceptions to the rule. As Kathy alluded to earlier with the ceded territories, there are treaty rights, the Ojibwe people who have rights to harvest in Wisconsin, whether if they're from Minnesota or Michigan or Wisconsin tribes. Other than that, anybody else can harvest wild rice as long as they're a resident of Wisconsin.
And need to be licensed.
Correct. You would need a license if you're between the ages of 17 and 64. If you're younger or older than that range, then one would not have to purchase a license.
John in South Range has a question. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi. Actually, I have more than one. I'm glad you picked this topic. It's unusual, but it pertains to our area for sure. Let's see. Well, the first one was that is the decreasing harvest. Is that a bellwether or a canary in the coal mine for other things in the environment? So when this is threatened, are there other things that also may be having an effect because of warming? And you may have covered this earlier. Is it actually a rice, wild rice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then if you have time for the third one, have there ever been like archaeological discoveries of the oldest existence of wild rice in a settlement?
Hmm. Okay. Interesting questions, John. And well, let's take the one question about is wild rice a rice? And Kathleen, do you want to take that?
Yes, wild rice is actually considered a grain, specifically a whole grain. So it's actually a seed of an aquatic grass, so it's not really a true rice.
Okay, and what about this wild rice being a bellwether? We did address that a little bit, but Jason?
Yeah, actually, Glyphwick has done a climate change vulnerability assessment for a number of different species, and actually what arose to the top in terms of most vulnerable, unfortunately, was wild rice, I believe. So, yeah, to that point, I think, you know, that could be a sign of risks of things to come for other species as well.
And archaeological, is there, I don't know, Kathleen, if you're familiar, or Jason for that matter, but Kathleen, will maybe go to you first. Archaeological findings of, you know, the original, you know, going back a long way in terms of its history, wild rice?
I haven't heard of any cases of that, but that doesn't say that, you know, wild rice was potentially found in archaeological areas, but I'm not aware of any cases at this moment.
But it's kind of been there and used by native peoples for forever, pretty much, has it? I mean, at least that's the thinking?
Yes, it has. So we actually came here from the Atlantic Ocean, you know, coming through the St. Lawrence River system. So we traveled and migrated this way to go where the food grows on the water. So it's been believed, you know, that journey had taken, you know, thousands of years for us to get here. So that was through a prophecy. So Manoman, you know, is one of our four main feast foods. So it's really it's a really beautiful relative that helps us, you know, kind of sustains our way of life today.
Let's, John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Claire in Sauk County.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. Kathleen mentioned motorboats, and that inspired my questions. Does wild rice grow above the water level? Is it visible? And number two, do kayaks, canoes, paddle boards, et cetera, non-motorized craft, do they harm the wild rice?
Okay. Jason, do you want to start?
Sure. Wild rice, is a grass. So it actually does, it's an emergent wetland plant. So which means that it starts by growing underwater in the sediment, and then it goes through a life cycle where it reaches a floating leaf stage to the top of the water, and eventually the full plant will emerge out of the water, and it could stick anywhere from a foot out of water up to 8 feet. And what we really haven't talked about yet is that there's actually two different species of wild rice in Wisconsin. That for all intents and purposes, the one that we talk about the most is what we call northern wild rice, or Azania palustris. the other species, the southern rice, or Zizania aquatica, which is actually much taller, but ironically, the seeds are smaller, so which is much less used for harvesting. So you would find that plant more frequently in river bottoms, especially in southern Wisconsin, Mississippi River systems.
Does anybody harvest that southern?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm sure there's been attempts, but I think a lot of people give up when they try. But to the caller's other question about boating, motor boating certainly does cause a threat, especially with the wake action or wave action that actually uproots plants. But more of the non-motorized watercraft is much better, I guess, for rice beds. Paddle boats or like more flat bottom boats can actually like mush or mash down the plants as you're going over on top of it. So it's a little more intrusive. That's why people harvest wild rice via canoe, where it has a tip or point that kind of parts the grass, if you will.
Oh, that makes that makes very good sense. And Rob emailed to ask how Ojibwe migration, how that story demonstrates the value of wild rice to Native peoples. Kathleen.
Oh, yes. So we value Manoman, you know, that's like a spiritual being, because it was, you know, it was told by prophecy for us to go where the food grows on the water. So initially in the Atlantic area, you know, we were foretold to go where the food grows on the water, because if we stayed, we would perish, meaning that the resources were kind of getting stretched, you know, on the Atlantic seaboard. So that's why we had this this prophecy and believe it, you know, it's like faith. So we did, you know, begin that journey along the St. Lawrence River. It's just really a profound story, you know, to have that faith to go where the food grows on the water. So we actually followed a Mita shell in the sky, you know, to where we know Madeline Island is like the center of it, this Great Lakes Basin, for, you know, where Manoman resides today.
And so the slowly, or maybe not so slowly, traveled across the country following wild rice.
Yes, so we actually had settlements along the way. There's a book called The Mishomas Book by Eddie Benton Benet. He talks about, you know, that journey where we had actually stops. There was like fishing villages. We would stop and, you know, and camp. And, you know, eventually a group of people would continue, you know, with the migration, you know, coming westward, you know. Well, that's where we kind of settled today in this space, you know, the Great Lakes Basin.
It's kind of interesting as I think about your work. Let me ask it this way. How do you combine your knowledge of the cultural meaning of Manoman with the kind of the modern scientific strategies to protect wild rice?
So we try to do our co-management. So, for instance, Jason Fleener and I are co-chairs for the Joint State Tribal Wild Rice Committee. So this is where science and culture kind of come together, you know, for co-management decisions, you know, with Manoman. So I'm able to offer up, you know, some of the traditional ways of thinking or some of the teachings, you know, to help with the science side, the Western way of thinking, too. So that's where we kind of come together, you know, to be able to do co-management, you know, for Manoman.
And Jason, how do you view it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this partnership is very critical. The state working with tribes, and I give a lot of credit to all the Ojibwe tribes, Glyphwick, and even other tribes in Wisconsin who have done so much work for wild rice. Wisconsin DNR staff do a lot to manage rice and protect it, but there's only so much we can do. So the partnership, we really complement each other's work well, I think.
And I would imagine other organizations could play a role too, like Wisconsin Wetlands Association or something, a group like that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of different organizations interested in conserving rice, and it's sometimes it just starts with education. Facilitating webinars, shows like this, for example, or research. There's a lot of academic researchers, institutions around the Midwest. There's a lot more wild rice research going on now than I think there's ever been done. So, duck hunting organizations, Ducks Unlimited, Wisconsin Waterfowl Association are doing a lot of work for wild rice. They really recognize its importance, not just for rice, but also the effect it has on ducks and other species.
Barry in Viroqua has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Barry.
Yes, good morning. Considering the threat to wild rice and the habitat, has there been any experimentation with trying to replicate the cold conditions? I know this probably sounds crazy, but to replicate the cold conditions and then germinate the rice and then transplant it. Has there been any experimentation with that?
Interesting. Kathleen, do you want to start and Jason can pipe in?
Sure. University of Minnesota had a student that actually took Manomen seed from a couple of sites, around the Twin Cities. They were able to overwinter it. So they wanted to know, when it germinated, what were the conditions. So that was a pretty interesting study. She had just finished up her thesis. So sometimes what I'll do is through research, I'll support or be an advisor, to some of the young researchers. So her research really showed, what temperatures that it needed to be at, what water bodies. So it was kind of like preliminary findings, at when that seed would germinate. But as far as I know some people, apart from the research that tried to start the seed and then it's really difficult to transplant Manomen because it needs to stick into, substrate, which is really difficult. I've tried it, where if I see a Manomen, floating on the top, and I've even tried to use my paddle to kind of stick it back into the substrate. Sometimes it's very difficult. Sometimes it works. So it's, pretty difficult. I've known a tribe in southern Michigan, too, that has done that. But I'm not sure what the success had been.
Yeah, go ahead, Jason, as well.
Yeah, I guess I don't have anything else to add. There's, like I said, there's so much research going on right now, a lot of different laboratory studies, but there are none others that I'm aware of that like looked at germination temperatures. But whenever people do research with wild rice in a laboratory setting, they really have to be careful because it is, like Kathy said, hard to raise in a lab setting and then transplant into the wild, if you will, and to be successful.
Let's take another call. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Stella.
Hi. My question is concerning PFAS. Are the waters that the wild rice is growing in polluted with PFAS, and does the plant take them up, and has there been any testing done to see if there is PFAS in the wild rice?
Jason?
Yeah, it's interesting you should ask that question because there is some research UW-Madison is looking at that very question. They're collecting wild rice in the St. Louis River estuary, which is just outside of Superior, Wisconsin, and some of the more polluted areas to see if there is PFAS uptake. So I don't think we have answers to that yet, but I think that is a very important question to see if there is any contamination in the environment that would affect humans as we eat it.
Yeah, it certainly would be. Someone else is wondering, when can wild rice be harvested in Wisconsin? Jason, what do you?
Sure, I can take that one. So it depends, but generally speaking, late August, about the last week of August and the first 2 weeks of September. So really, as we speak, I would say right now is kind of the tail end of the harvest season, but that really depends on the lake or river. Generally speaking, and Kathy confirmed, I think usually rivers tend to, their rice tends to ripen a little earlier than some of the bigger lakes do. But yeah, late August, early September, and it's really important when harvesters go out to test the rice first, and if it's not falling immediately, then they should back out and then come a few days later until it's ripe.
Yeah. Kathleen, anything to add there?
Yes. So I always shoot for Labor Day weekend. So that's a good indicator for when Monoman is, you know, ready to rock and roll. But like Jason had said, you always got to test that ripeness of rice. If that first part, which is usually the top that ripens first, is not offering itself up, is to, you know, definitely, you know, think about it and come back at a later time, because you don't want to harvest green wild rice because it's not ready yet.
John in Price County called, couldn't stay with us, asked if non-native people can grow wild rice, and if so, where can they get advice for growing it on their property?
Yeah, I guess I could take that one. So yeah, wild rice, whether if it's a public water or a private water, there aren't any restrictions or permits needed to plant it. If it's done on a private body water, like a pond, you know, it will be most successful, like as Kathy mentioned before, if there's an inlet or outlet, a spring or some very small flow of water, that's where it really thrives. So, you know, one could go out and harvest themselves and then transplant that anywhere that they want to plant it. The only thing that DNR recommends is if they do it on a public body of water, is to be very mindful of where you plant it. And if there are a lot of, there's a lot of boat traffic or shoreline owners that might not be welcoming of planting it in a certain spot, then it's probably not the right place.
Yeah. So how do we protect? Both of you can comment on this. Maybe start with you. How can individuals do to help ensure wild rice beds flourish, Kathleen?
So we want to be mindful, like Jason said, first you got to be able to identify, you know, our beautiful relative. So educate yourself on where wild rice is, what it looks like, especially that most vulnerable stage, you know, at the floating leaf stage. So that's when we try to stay out of the rice beds, especially with motorized boats. Canoes will kind of, you know, gently flow over the floating leaf stage, but it's best to kind of stay out of it. So then that way, you know, it could continue to age and to be able to stand up. So that's the best thing that I could say is just, you know, educate yourself about Monoman and where it's at, the habitat. Even if you go into a lake, you know, you can also go to the Wisconsin DNR site, and it will state that, you know, rice is in that water body.
Yeah. And so that's a feature, Jason, that the DNR does to kind of help with wild rice.
Yeah, so on the Wisconsin DNR website, dnr.wi.gov, you could search for wild rice harvesting, and it'll bring you to our webpage. And it has everything on there from harvest regulations to where to find wild rice. And there's an interactive web mapping tool where one could see if there is a presence of rice or not, especially in northern Wisconsin where it's been inventoried the heaviest. It doesn't necessarily say where it's located on that lake or how abundant it is, just if it's present. So that should give people a good idea of an awareness if it's there.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you both for taking time to talk with us today about wild rice and its production and its cultural meanings. Kathleen Smith from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, one of our guests. Jason Fleener, a wetland habitat specialist for the Wisconsin DNR with a very strong interest in wild rice as well. Great to have both of you with us. Thank you so much. And we'll be turning our attention to carbon pricing next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.